Hello, and welcome to The Brief, a video podcast that explores vital issues and events in international affairs and brings you perspective and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Clancy. In just 11 days, a number of Syrian opposition militant groups forced President Bashar al-Assad to flee the country for asylum in Russia. It was a dramatic and, for many, unexpected power shift that fundamentally changes the dynamics of the Middle East. What is Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and its leader, Ahmed al-Sharaa, who has used the nom de guerre, Abu Muhammad al-Jalani? The transitional government is saying that it will pursue the worst actors in Assad's government, but it's promising a peaceful and inclusive future for Syria. Still, for the estimated 25 million Syrians, what does lie ahead? Who were the winners and losers in this sudden development? How did the war in Ukraine have an impact? What about the 6 million Syrians who fled abroad? Already a dozen countries have announced they're suspending asylum applications. Well, joining us to analyze these events in Syria is Ken Robinson, a decorated military veteran in special operations, counterterrorism, and national security, a member of the Defense Intelligence Hall of Fame. He has keen insights about what we're witnessing in Syria right now. Ken Robinson, hello, and welcome to The Brief.
Hey, Jim.
Great to have you with us. This is a time of great uncertainty, and I think we have to start at the beginning. Who is this group that has taken over Syria, and what about their leader? Isn't he on the terrorist list?
You are absolutely right, and now that they have succeeded, it's one thing to take a country. It's another to be able to keep it and govern it, and the group is a collection of groups, some of which we still don't even know their names, because there's so many proxy fighters from different nation states who all have an interest in what's going on here right now. But the group that is the predominant group is called HTS, and that's Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, and the abbreviation for it is HTS, and it's led by Abu Muhammad al-Jalani. And right now, he is the person who is the man who led the fight and is the predominant man who said, I just took Damascus.
He's also a guy who said, I'm with al-Qaeda. And then he was with ISIS, or he was, you know, the other way around.
That is correct. In his embryonic stages of development, as each of these groups tries to self-identify as to who they are and what their objectives are, and then they try to figure out, okay, we need friends, relatives, and acquaintances, because we're not arms manufacturers, and wars move with soldiers with their bellies, and they need weapons, and so they need friends. And so they've reached out, and they established proxy links with all these other groups, but they didn't necessarily decide whether or not they were going to keep those brands of those other groups. I think those were more relationships of opportunity. And the United States government right now, as you said, has them designated as a terrorist organization. And before the U.S. can engage, they have to dispel that. They've got to sort out who they're actually dealing with. Now, what made it easy was Bashar, on his way out the door, said, don't fight. Turn the country over to the two guys. And I'm telling my government that's still here, that hasn't run away, cooperate with whoever shows up. And so the HTS has designated Mohammed al-Bashir to be their interim leader. And Mohammed al-Bashir is like a caretaker prime minister. And what this does is it signals a shift between going from the insurgents, their ideology, into some form of government with some form of legitimacy that will enable the U.S. to have someone that they can talk to. Because, you know, our law says if there's a coup or a nation is overthrown, we do not have any diplomatic relations with whoever these coup takers are until that gets sorted out in the international community. So for them to join the international community of nations, they need this prime minister to be deemed legitimate, and then they'll start talking. Quietly behind channels, they're already talking. But I'm talking about
Iran claims that all of its losses, the downfall of Bashar al-Assad, the decimation of Hezbollah in Lebanon, all part of a U.S.-Israeli plan, or plot is the term that they use, as Washington supplies the weapons and Israel's Air Force drops the bombs.
Yeah. First of all, we just spent 20 years in a forever war. And in that 20-year forever war, we had soldiers leaving FOBs, going out and doing show of force operations in Iraq, Afghanistan. And what they were greeted with? They were greeted with IEDs, explosively designed bombs that could penetrate their vehicles. And every one of them had a ticket on them that said, made in Iran, because they were the proxy fighters stepping up the Taliban. And now we have generations of people with traumatic brain injury from Iran. Iran has been the person causing problems with the Ministry of Intelligence Services and with their Quds force all over the region for years. And the West, Israel, other Arab nations on the Sunni side have all been doing everything they can to make sure they don't see an Iranian emergence as a regional power that it wants to be. It would love to be in charge of the caliphate. And so it has strange bedfellows. The most important one has been their proxy relationship with Russia. The thing that the losers in this is Iran and Hezbollah, because they now don't have the Iran-Syria-Hezbollah axis where they were able to make the overland routes with arms, drugs, money, slavery, all the malfeasance that Iran has been doing through its proxy intelligence services. Now all that's cut off. And now because of the decapitation that occurred with the Israelis against Hezbollah, and now what's happening with Hamas, and now what's happening down in Sheba Farms in the south, and the Israel taking over the Golan Heights, the entire region has changed overnight. With the Israelis now attacking the chemical weapon sites, destroying their navy, destroying their air force, the United States attacking ISIS in every location where they can find them still in their training camps, because right now the Kurds are sitting on a prisoner of war facility with thousands of ISIS fighters. And while they're doing that, suddenly they're having to defend themselves from a opportunistic Turkey who wants to come in now and give it to the Kurds. Because we have this dynamic, Jim, we are witnessing the unfinished business of World War I. Because at the end of World War I, we left the Kurds with a promise of a nation state, and all we left them is a nation overlapping multiple states, and each one sees them as friend or foe. And that war of attrition has been going on back and forth for years, and now every side is trying to solidify itself and its new position to try to see who's going to come out on top. And nobody really knows.
This rebel alliance, though, didn't emerge on its own. It needed food, ammunition. It needed outside support in order to survive, whether it came from Turkey, the U.S., or Arab states, right?
It's very likely that the groups in the Middle East, from Saudi Arabia with MBS to even the United Arab Emirates, each had an interest in having peace. And from that standpoint, we don't really know which sides decided to pony up money to support operations. But clearly, they had a lot of backing for this offensive, because this offensive just didn't happen overnight. This was a plan, and it was executed in 11 days, and it was brilliant. And what most people lost was the fact that the first place they took was Aleppo. And Aleppo, to them, is like taking Mecca, because that is a place that's deep in the heart of the soul of who they see themselves as a people. And then with that as the wind against their back, then it was a race to Damascus.
Well, Assad clearly saw the writing on the wall, and he fled for Russia. Russia's a loser in this too, isn't it? I mean, it's already obviously preoccupied with Ukraine.
I think the history of this, Jim, is that we're going to see, depending on what happens with the new administration, we may see this as a big black mark on the wall for Vladimir Putin, because he was forced to remove forces from Syria and place them back into Ukraine, along with his mercenaries from the prisons and Chechnya and North Korea, because of the attrition of forces of his regular army and his inability to recruit and retrain and train new forces and push them to the front. You know, they've lost over 100,000. that we can for sure say that started on day one are no longer with us. And that's a serious blow for an army. And now losing his proxy, and by losing that proxy, he's not just losing a friend, he's losing the ports. He's losing those ports of call, and he's losing that liaison that he was able to have with all of those other proxy relationships with Iran throughout that area, and it weakens Russia and its ability to project power and its interest in the Middle East. And he's going to be graded on that by his own country, because they're looking at this special military operation that was supposed to be 3 days and is now looking like 3 years, and they don't have a lot to show for it.
As I've watched this play out on my television screen, I've seen obviously distraught Syrians literally tearing through prison documents in a frantic effort to find loved ones. But these documents and so many others are everywhere, and you have noted in writing that they've got to be preserved and protected. They're vital. They're evidence of the regime's war crimes.
That there is an effort to get NGOs into place to help, and there seems to be a level of cooperation with the people who have taken and are currently holding Damascus. There's a separation between the fighters that got them there and secured it, and then the group of people who are saying, we must quickly get to governance. Because until we get to governance, we can't get to foreign aid. And without foreign aid, we can't rebuild. And part of that rebuilding is to make our case as to how evil this regime actually was. And that requires a sensitive site exploitation, not just relatives touching these documents, but they must have a chain of custody with them. And international organizations are trying to get in there and help with that process. And so are intrepid journalists. And between those people in the early stages, that's going to be the key to being able to understand who these people were. If you recall, when we took Kandahar, when we took the Afghanistan Taliban regime down in 2002, one of the first places that we went to was Osama bin Laden's house. And we were able to beat the military and the Central Intelligence Agency to his house because we knew where it was. And we went into the basement. And in that basement, what did we find? We found all of al-Qaeda's distance learning library. Everything from all of their distributed networks in every country in the world. And then Nick Robertson put together a team, and we brought all that back to the United States, document exploited it, and that became Terror on Tape, that presentation which won the Peabody Award. And it laid out in 5 days exactly how this regime was working, exactly how they were targeting, and who they were targeting, and why they were targeting, to explain to the American people what they were looking at. And that's what needs to happen here. All of this needs to be placed into context, because right now it's been white noise in the background while people have been focused on the fact that in the United States we're so distracted by our domestic politics, which is now going to be focused with a change of administration. And everything is going to be keyed to what will the policy be of the new administration vis-a-vis Russia, Ukraine, and then dealing with these countries here as they're now sorting out governance.
Let me pick up on that briefly, because President-elect Trump has said that he would end the war in Ukraine, and many believe that his solution would come at the cost of a lot of Ukraine's territory. President Zelensky doesn't want to give that up. Does President-elect Trump have to be careful here?
I think anything that gets Vladimir Putin an off-ramp saves Putin. That's for sure, because he's suffering. And they have mass. They have the ability to continually throw bodies. We look at their past history and previous wars. They will just keep throwing bodies until they achieve their objective. People don't know in the United States that in the Second World War, the USSR lost 28 million soldiers. 28 million mass to be able to push through and then enable the Normandy invasion to come through and for us then to meet in Berlin and defeat the Nazis.
So, well, there's a lot at stake.
They're a determined people and they don't like to lose. And now they're losing prestige because their generals have died. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers have been killed and wounded. And they don't have a lot to show for it other than what they started with, the two breakaway republics and the Dnieper River. And, you know, unless they do something completely strategic, like a offensive that goes over and seizes Odessa and makes Ukraine a landlocked country, then that's the only thing that really changes the bargaining chip as to who's going to be able to have negotiation positions. President Zelensky has said that there is certain things that he believes are not on the bargaining table, one of them being the return of Crimea. Personally, I think just as an analyst looking at Russian behavior, I don't see a scenario ever where Crimea would be handed back over to Ukraine simply because of the strategic reason he took it. He took it because it threatened the warm water port and the Black Sea fleet. Once Ukraine turned west, instead of looking east, he had to secure the Black Sea fleet, and that meant he had to take Crimea. That was a strategic move on his part because it was a vital interest. It's his only warm water access to a country where everything else is frozen. Until recently, until just recently, when now the Arctic is now becoming a free fire zone, and everyone's up there trying to compete and see how that's going to go.
All right, that's for another day. But you're basically saying Trump has to find a policy that doesn't hand any favors to Vladimir Putin.
Well, I think everyone has to be able to walk away from this with something, or it won't be a bargain that guarantees peace. It will simply be a time for everyone to rearm, and then an offensive will pick back up in 18 months. And that's not what we need. This is going to require great statecraft, because even though President Putin doesn't feel that Zelensky is a person he can negotiate with, but he does believe he can negotiate with the new president, the new president still has to understand that the sitting president of Ukraine must sell whatever that negotiated deal is to the population who has just lost its blood and treasure fighting their cousins. And that's going to be difficult, because it's one thing to win a piece of paper. It's another to actually win the peace and for have us get to a point where Ukraine has some status that maybe is not east or west and maybe is Switzerland. That is one of the proposals that's on the table past Minsk II, was why not make them something like that where neither side has them and they become a bridge between the two. A lot of people look at that and say, well, yeah, that makes a lot more sense than the xenophobic nature of Russia having another NATO alliance country sitting right on its border, which was the reason why it took Crimea to begin with.
I want to go back to Syria. You're particularly concerned about that minority group inside Syria. We've heard assurances from the new leadership that they're not going to go after anyone. That's not their intention at all, but it could be payback time for the Alawites.
I wrote a paper on it day before yesterday around midnight, and I said, are the Alawites next? Well, yesterday evening, around the same time, the Alawites got it. They've started the purge, and they've started purging Alawite cities and killing whole populations. They're doing it right now as we speak, because no one really is controlled from the central government to all the angry people in all of these different groups. There is no true governance out there. There are just a mishmash of militias who all came together with a common goal to get rid of a common enemy, and now they're pulling back now that they've gotten rid of that common enemy and are all trying to decide now who gets to be in charge. And there are people that have vendettas. Remember that Assad's father was a man who couldn't excel in Syrian politics because he was an Alawite. And the only option for him was to join the military. And so he joined the military and became an Air Force pilot. And then he got involved in Syrian politics and got involved in two coups in the 60s. There was two coups. And in the second coup, he got himself elected prime minister. And in that second coup, then, from that time forward, he started taking Alawites and placing them in positions of responsibility over the Sunnis, because most of the Syrians are Sunni. And so then, for the last 50 years, this small sect of Alawites have been lording over an angry population of Sunnis. And now the vacuum plug has been pulled. There's no one to protect them, and they are at great danger. And any Alawite that's left, if he's smart, is trying to find a way out of there because they're in great danger simply because no one's controlling these militia groups. And they're going to take whatever they can from these people. There's going to be a massive transfer of wealth and power. It's just the way it is.
It is, and it's a dangerous time. Syrians, not out of the woods yet. Even those who have fled the country, there's what, 6 million, I believe, 7 million internally displaced, 6 million have fled the war. About 3 million are in Turkey, another million are in Germany, and already more than a dozen countries have come out and said, we're freezing all applications for asylum, and because we've got elections upcoming in some of these countries, there's an anti-immigrant feel here. Politicians are using this moment to stand up and say, we're going to deport all Syrians, or we're going to send all the Syrians home. They put it in nicer terms. We're going to facilitate their return to help rebuild their country. But many of them, of course, have no home, nothing to go back to. So it's a very difficult time for them as well. But they're important in all of this.
Yes. The challenge of the diaspora, the challenge of returning fighters who then decide it's okay, I've achieved my objective of my jihad, now I'm going to bring my gun and I'm going to go home. Because what happens when people fight for 10 years? When they go home, they start wars of national liberation wherever they came from, historically. And so we see this reverberate right now. We're seeing in Asia right now the returning of fighters from the 20-year wars that we had in Iraq and Afghanistan, coming with ISIS returning to Indonesia, with Jamaah Islamiyah returning, Abu Sayyaf, all the groups that went off and just said, well, let's go get our training and fight against the American imperialists. And now they're coming home, and they're not coming home to open up shops. They're coming home to make mischief. And so all over the region, there needs to be a conference, almost like the conferences we had at the end of the post-World War II, like Yalta, where all the great powers came together and said, how do we put this all back together again? What type of procedures must we put in place? What about the United Nations? What about a Marshall Plan? What about, there needs to be the same type of effort and focus done to win the peace. Because if we don't, if we let them each fester, we'll be fighting these individual groups again in 2 years. And we'll have all been for naught. Or we can pay the money up front early and have a policy attached to it and a strategy attached to it that the stakeholders are all in agreement with, and we can find a way toward peace and governance. And we can identify the one thing that kills terrorist recruitment and retention. Hope. We always say we're declaring war on terror. We're declaring war on drugs. Well, terror and drugs don't have armies. They don't have capitals. They don't have a Waterloo battle where you have a decisive end. But the one thing where you can find a closest way toward governance is hope. And hope comes with business, with jobs, with schools, with education, mothers, children. That's what gets you toward governance and a better society. And instead of us having this continual military-industrial complex of who are we going to fund next for foreign military sales, we need to be thinking about hope and hopelessness.
That is something that has to be taking place sooner, not later. And,
right.
I know it's very early, but I'm not seeing those moves being made. I think everybody right now is waiting for things to shake out. How far will it go with, acts of retribution against the Alawites? How far will it go as these guys begin to try to carve up their own territory and the various groups that were part of this united front that they put on at least for 11 days?
And we still don't know where all the weapons of mass destruction sites are that he has hidden, the biological warfare and the chemical. Majority of them were bombed because they were always on target list. But there's still many that were bunkered and veiled in the same way that Iran has bunkered and veiled its sites to include its nuclear sites. And so there is a lot of intelligence pouring over that whole area, watching for reemergence of ISIS with the United States Air Force, the Israelis watching the reemergence of anything that could allow a militia group to get its hands on a helicopter, a weapons stash, anything that they would be a threat to their national security while they're still fighting their active war with Hamas and Hezbollah and settling their issues with Lebanon so that they're not fighting multiple fronts. And so everything is in a state of flux, of crazy right now. But it's irresponsible for anyone to try to go in and put people's lives at risk until we first have some sort of governance. And there may be some sort of peacekeeping arrangement that may come through. There are quiet talks right now among donor-type nations that have the bodies and have the heart, but don't yet know whether strategically it's the right move for their nation state. But they're talking about it. And at least that's better than not. That those states, and that's not the United States. That's other concerned Muslim countries who know that this is our problem. Because that's the other problem that we seem to do in our policies. We always think that we can come in and give our solution, and then that's going to be the best solution. And it hardly ever is the best solution. The best solution is for them to govern themselves regionally and settle their own disputes, and for us to try to help in whatever way we can with our national power. But not with our military power, not with our soldiers on the ground being policemen. That policy failed in Iraq and Afghanistan horribly. When we asked our soldiers to be policemen and to be mayors of cities and to do civic works when they were trained to be soldiers and win the nation's wars, not to be police.
You have strong feelings about that, but I want to turn to something you touched on there, and that is, the Israelis would seem to be the winners in this because, once again, there's chaos. They saw Hezbollah, you know, one of the major concerns of recent Israeli governments has always been Hezbollah as they built up the arms and the missiles. Now they've cut off the supply of those. But at the same time, they see a weakened Iran and they suddenly realize this could push them to develop that nuclear weapon that Netanyahu's been warning about. For 30 years.
Israel is emerging as the strategic winner as we all look at the game pieces on the board right this minute. The Iranian arms routes through Syria are disrupted. And everyone's watching them like a hawk, and anything that moves is getting bombed. They've gained a significant advantage in curbing Hezbollah's capabilities. They are reorganizing themselves. Everyone is afraid in Hezbollah to say, okay, who's next in charge? Because, you know, a hand kind of goes up, and the minute the hand goes up, a missile comes down. Because they're watching. They know where they are, and they have the will and the resolve to say, never again are we going to sit and watch you reconstitute your capability and then torture us for 10 years in a row. They now have a strategy. Israel does.
The people who have said that Iran is in the worst position it's been in decades, that the Middle East has changed more than it has in decades, they're right.
I agree.
How do the Europeans play this to take advantage of that, to encourage it, to make the right thing happen?
Well, it's interesting that in the Ukraine situation, within the National Security Council structure, General Kellogg has been given the portfolio of Ukraine-Russia. And General Kellogg is a storied special operations soldier going back to Vietnam and who handled operations in European command. And at a time when our interest was in protecting Sarajevo, I happened to have worked for General Kellogg forward when I was commanding forces in Sarajevo. In special mission forces, special operations forces. That is an extremely competent man who understands the problem and understands Russia. The national security advisor that the incoming administration has chosen is another special forces officer who worked in going all the way back to the Reagan White House on these problems. And so those two people are not newcomers. And their mindset is one of seizing opportunities. And so I can only suspect that the president is going to listen to them and listen to their great experience that they have and recognize that there's great opportunities for decisive new statesmanship, both through quiet diplomacy and grand bargains. They're going to do a very delicate balancing act because right now they got to prevent ISIS from resurging. That's the number one priority, and the Air Force has been bombing them every night. They're on it. They didn't waste 1 minute and started hitting targets. They have to make sure that Turkey doesn't start killing the Kurds, who have been very loyal allies to the United States. And Turkey is an ally of NATO. But there's this one disconnect here where this problem of a nation state overlapping the, where you have a nation overlapping the state boundaries of others with the Kurdish question, which has been with us since the end of World War I, which would have been solved except for what? They found oil. And once they found oil, all of a sudden the statehood was off. But the airstrikes right now are being very effective. The diplomatic efforts that are going to require Turkey as a key player, because they can influence HTS. They are the ones that can speak to them the most and marginalize their behavior and maintain pressure on Iran while monitoring what Israel is doing. It's a very delicate balancing act. We've got to prevent wars of retribution. That's our number one priority right now, is saving people's lives of both the Alawites, Kurds, our allies in the region who helped us, and many of them are Turkey's perceived enemies, and so it's very complicated. And Washington has got some stated conditions for supporting the new government, and that has to meet them. They have to have credibility. They have to have inclusivity. They have to have an adherence to international norms. And then they have to underscore the challenges of legitimizing HTS, getting it off of the state-sponsored terrorist list, and reevaluating who they are today as opposed to who they were when they first got into this game a decade ago. And that's a delicate balancing act, and it's going to be the number one priority of the new administration as they juggle that Middle East portfolio and figuring out the off-ramp for the Ukraine-Russia scenario.
Indeed, dramatic developments everywhere you turn. And thank you, Ken Robinson, for your perspective. The challenge now, how to build hope and support a better future for the people of Syria and the wider Middle East.
Can I give a plug in a minute as we go off?
Sure.
I've been traveling to the Middle East for 40 years, as you have. And the one thing that we share in common is we know the common people. I'm not talking about the governments. I'm not talking about their military. I'm talking about the common people in these regions. And they are lovely people with rich histories. And their regions are lovely places that could be economically thriving if we could simply shift the focus back to embracing the history and the civilization's gifts that they gave the West and create tourist destinations out of these places that are currently death camps. We have to do everything we can to wage a war on that and bring hope to that region. That's where we need to spend $1 trillion, not on more weapons.
Ken Robinson, thank you for being with us on The Brief.
Thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure.
And thank you for joining us. Please explore our many other episodes of The Brief podcast. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Give us a like or subscribe. For a complete listing, you can find more information at thebriefpodcast.org. For now, I'm Jim Clancy, and you've been briefed. Welcome to The Brief. I'm Jim Clancy. This episode features Ken Robinson, a decorated U.S. military veteran and national security expert who answers some key questions about Syria and the risks as a new transitional government takes over after decades of rule by the Assad dynasty.
How do we put this all back together again? What type of procedures must we put in place? What about the United Nations? What about a Marshall Plan? What about there needs to be the same type of effort and focus done to win the peace? Because if we don't, if we let them each fester, we'll be fighting these individual groups again in 2 years, and we'll have all been for naught. Or we can pay the money up front early and have a policy attached to it and a strategy attached to it that the stakeholders are all in agreement with, and we can find a way toward peace and governance. and we can identify the one thing that kills terrorist recruitment and retention. Hope. We always say we're declaring war on terror. We're declaring war on drugs. Well, terror and drugs don't have armies. They don't have capitals. They don't have a Waterloo battle where you have a decisive end. But the one thing where you can find a closest way toward governance is hope. And hope comes with business, with jobs, with schools, with education, mothers, children. That's what gets you toward governance and a better society. And instead of us having this continual military-industrial complex of who are we going to fund next for foreign military sales, we need to be thinking about hope and hopelessness.
Assad clearly saw the writing on the wall, and he fled for Russia. Russia's a loser in this too, isn't it? I mean, it's already obviously preoccupied with Ukraine.
I think the history of this, Jim, is that we're going to see, depending on what happens with the new administration, we may see this as a big black mark on the wall for Vladimir Putin, because he was forced to remove forces from Syria and place them back into Ukraine, along with his mercenaries from the prisons and Chechnya and North Korea, because of the attrition of forces of his regular army and his inability to recruit and retrain and train new forces and push them to the front. You know, they've lost over 100,000 that we can for sure say that started on day one are no longer with us. And that's a serious blow for an army. And now losing his proxy, and by losing that proxy, he's not just losing a friend, he's losing the ports. He's losing those ports of call, and he's losing that liaison that he was able to have with all of those other proxy relationships with Iran throughout that area, and it weakens Russia and its ability to project power and its interest in the Middle East. And he's going to be graded on that by his own country, because they're looking at this special military operation that was supposed to be 3 days and is now looking like 3 years, and they don't have a lot to show for it.
That was Ken Robinson. You can watch this or all of our conversations on The Brief Podcast on YouTube or listen on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. For now, I'm Jim Clancy. Thanks for joining us.